the 19th of December, 2024, and this is the last weekly Reveille show before Christmas. This is your volunteer reader and flying staff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you news of interest to our veterans community here in Arizona. Today we have news from our military news websites, as well as our veteran service organizations, and of course the Veterans Administration. So let's get right into it. We'll start with Stripes.com, which is the official website of the Stars and Stripes newspaper. Start with this article by Philip Walter Wellman. Remember what it was all for, U.S. veterans in Europe, to mark World War II Battle of the Bulge. This is from the 14th of December, Bastogne, Belgium. Some of the last living American veterans of World War II on Saturday met with world leaders and many other admirers as they recounted how the Allies braved sub-freezing temperatures to blunt the final Nazi offensive, which began 80 years ago on Monday. The Battle of the Bulge ceremonies in Belgium and Luxembourg capped a series of major remembrances in Europe this year, including the 80th anniversary of D-Day in June and other liberation milestones. The 17 veterans, who are either centenarians or in their late 90s now, were honored along with their fallen comrades in the bitterly fought Ardennes campaign, where over 19,000 American troops lost their lives. I want people to remember not only what we went through, but what it was all for, David Marshall, 100, said on the sidelines of celebrations in Bastogne. Marshall recalled fighting in heavy snow and without warm clothing. The cold was as deadly as the Nazis, he said. I went into the war as a naive 20-year-old from New York, Marshall said. After the Battle of the Bulge, I was a veteran soldier. Named for the shape of the German advance carved into Allied lines, the battle began December the 16th, 1944, as Adolf Hitler launched a last-ditch counteroffensive in Western Europe. Despite initial chaos, stiff resistance by American units and reinforcements led to an Allied victory by January 1945. The battle's human toll was staggering, with over 19,000 American deaths, 47,500 wounded, and 23,000 missing or captured. German forces suffered similar casualties, and civilians in the Ardennes endured their own losses and hardships. Bastogne, a strategic crossroads town and a symbol of Allied resistance during the battle, hosted the largest commemorations Saturday. A parade included over a dozen World War II veterans who were wheeled through the streets to applause and waving American flags. Active duty American and Belgian soldiers also participated. Joseph R. Picard, who fought as a 19-year-old with the 552nd Field Artillery Battalion, remembered the brutal conditions made worse by the loss of his best friend just weeks before the battle. The important thing is that we succeeded, Picard said. You don't remember all the bad things, you remember the good things. However, he lamented a lack of awareness about World War II among younger Americans. They don't know much about it, he said, and you know what they say. If you don't keep the story alive, it's going to happen again, and we don't want it to happen again. Following the parade, the veterans joined government officials and the royal families of Belgium and Luxembourg in throwing nuts to crowds from a snowy balcony at Bastogne's town hall. The annual celebration recalls Brigadier General Anthony McAuliffe's famous one-word reply to a German surrender demand, nuts. The Army's 101st Airborne Division defense of Bastogne, while being surrounded, became a defining moment of the battle. The unit's current soldiers were prominently featured in commemorations throughout the weekend. Among them was Captain Alex Rodriguez, a judge advocate who honored his great uncle, a 101st veteran of the Battle of the Bulge. Something that I wanted to do for as long as I can remember, and to be able to come here as a member of the 101st Airborne is unbelievable, Rodriguez said. Earlier this year, the 101st conducted air assault drills during D-Day commemorations, stepping beyond their usual ceremonial roles. With fewer living World War II veterans, the responsibility of keeping the memory of World War II alive is increasingly falling to current soldiers. Isabeau Meuse from Flanders said her family travels to Bastogne annually and will continue to do so even when there is no living link to the war. "We'll still come to remember what they did and what happened," Meuse said. "Now I'm here with my parents, and when I have children, I expect to be here with them, too." Earlier Saturday, a ceremony was held at the Luxembourg American Cemetery in Luxembourg City, where more than 5,000 U.S. service members are buried, including General George S. Patton. That ceremony was attended by a large bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers, many of whom, it was noted, have family connections to World War II. Representative Michael McCaul, Republican of Texas, recalled his father who conducted B-17 bombing missions. "The significance of this battle must serve as a reminder that freedom is never free and that democracies around the world must rally to the cause of freedom when it's under attack," McCaul said. "It is our duty to preserve what these men fought for." One of the U.S. veterans at the Luxembourg ceremony, John D. Jack Foy, assured the crowd that the sacrifices of the soldiers who died in a battle wouldn't be forgotten. "I remember the bitter cold, the weight of my machine gun, and the faces of my brothers in arms, ordinary men who displayed extraordinary courage," said Foy, 99. "Together, we fought for freedom, step by painful step. To those who come after us," he added, "may you always remember that the freedom you cherish came at a terrible cost." Representative Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, was part of the delegation but suffered an injury in Luxembourg that required hip replacement surgery and transport Saturday to Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany. At a separate ceremony Friday at Bastogne's Battle of the Bulge Memorial, speakers, including members of the U.S. delegation and Belgian Foreign Minister Bernard Quinten, drew parallels between the battles of the Bulge and Ukraine's ongoing fight in the present day against Russia's full-scale invasion. "As we honor the memory of so many young soldiers who fell for the freedom of Europe, how can we not think of the Ukrainian soldiers today dying in the snow and frozen mud to defend their country against an unprovoked war of aggression," Quintin said. And that's Remember What It Was All For, U.S. Veterans in Europe, to mark World War II Battle of the Bulge. Svetlana Skolnikova of Stars and Stripes writes our next article, 15 military veterans convicted of nonviolent crimes receive pardons. This is from the 12th of December, Washington. 15 military veterans who were convicted of nonviolent crimes, including drug offenses, were granted pardons by President Joe Biden on Thursday. The veterans served in the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Coast Guard and will see their convictions wiped out alongside 24 others who are pardoned as Biden prepares to hand over power to President-elect Donald Trump in January. Nearly 1,500 people also received commutations in what the White House called the largest single-day grant of clemency in modern history. Many of the pardons were for people who committed offenses long ago and had turned their lives around. "America was built on the promise of possibility and second chances," Biden said. It is customary for a president to grant clemency at the end of his term to relieve a person of guilt or punishment in the case of a pardon or to commute a sentence. Among those receiving a pardon is 67-year-old Michael Gary Pelletier of Augusta, Maine, who served in the Coast Guard for 14 years and participated in nearly 800 search and rescue operations, saving 32 lives. He was honorably discharged and later served in the Coast Guard Reserve. Three veterans of the Vietnam War are also getting pardons: Kim Douglas Hammond, 75, of Lima, Ohio; Russell Thomas Portner, 74, of Toutle, Washington; and James Russell Stid, 79, of Groveport, Ohio. Hammond earned the U.S. Navy Commendation Medal and the Bronze Star during his service in the Army and was honorably discharged. Portner also earned the Bronze Star from the Army before being honorably discharged. Stid served in the Air Force after pleading guilty to a nonviolent offense at the age of 20 and was honorably discharged with the rank of sergeant. He then reenlisted and served for another 4 years, including in the Vietnam War, and left the military as a staff sergeant. Four other veterans who were convicted of nonviolent offenses in their 20s are also receiving pardons. Brandon Sergio Castrofle, 49, of Alexandria, Virginia. Gregory S. Ekman, 58, of Fountain Valley, California. Nathaniel David Reed III, 46, of San Antonio, Texas. And Jose Antonio Rodriguez, 55, of Coral Springs, Florida. Castrofle continued his career in the Army after completing his sentence and later went on to work as a civilian for the Army and Air Force. Ekman served in the Air Force, receiving several awards, and Rodriguez served in the Navy, earning the Achievement Medal and other commendations. Reed, who was convicted of nonviolent offenses at 21, served in the Air Force for 2 decades after his conviction and frequently deployed overseas. He retired at the rank of Master Sergeant and has used his experience overcoming the stigma of conviction to help mentor fellow airmen, according to the White House. Other veterans who were pardoned? Duran Arthur Brown, 44, of Cleveland. He's a Navy veteran who earned several medals and awards, and following an honorable discharge, served in the Navy Reserve. Paul John Garcia, 72, of Las Vegas. He served in the Navy, receiving the National Defense Service Medal and other awards. Edwin Allen Jones, 60, of Paducah, Kentucky. He served in the Army and was honorably discharged with the rank of captain. Jamal Lee King, 53, of North Ridgeville, Ohio. He's an Army veteran who received the National Defense Service Medal and other awards before being honorably discharged. Jerry Donald Manning, 70, of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, an Army veteran. He earned a medal during Operation Desert Storm in the Gulf War and was honorably discharged. Gary Michael Robinson, 70, of Redmond, Oregon. He served in the Army, earning the National Defense Service Medal and other awards, and later served as a reservist for several years. James Edgar Yarbrough, 79, of Arlington, Texas. He is a decorated Air Force veteran who earned more than a dozen medals and awards, including the Purple Heart Medal, an award given to those wounded or killed in service. He was honorably discharged at the rank of captain. That's 15 military veterans convicted of nonviolent crimes receive pardons. Our next article is by Linda F. Hershey of Stars and Stripes from the 16th of December. Disturbing and disgusting. House lawmakers investigate rampant sex, harassment, misconduct at Tennessee VA facility, Washington. The House Veterans Affairs Committee has investigated multiple whistleblower accounts of rampant sexual assault, misconduct, and consensual sexual activities that took place inside the VA Mountain Home Health Care Facility in Tennessee. Representative Mike Bost, Republican of Illinois, the committee chairman, said the 6-month investigation has confirmed at least 2 managers leveraged sexual favors from subordinates at the Department of Veterans Affairs medical facility in exchange for job promotions. Bost said the committee sent an oversight team to the Tennessee hospital to assess the situation and inform VA Secretary Dennis McDonough of the findings. The VA has launched its own investigation. The women claimed hospital supervisors knew about the sexual misconduct, but failed for months to act, according to the investigation by the House VA Committee's subpanel on oversight and investigations. If these allegations are verified, without question, these men and women have no business serving veterans in East Tennessee, and this should have never happened, Bost said about the hospital leaders. The VA has provided the House committee with certain documents related to the department's investigation into the Mountain Home facility. The information revealed sexual relationships and misconduct did occur on VA property in Tennessee, Bost said. The sexual misconduct, harassment, and inappropriate interpersonal relationships that were allowed to persist at the Mountain Home VA facility are disturbing and disgusting, he said. The House VA subpanel last week released findings and supporting documents of its investigation. In one incident, whistleblowers reported a male worker had consensual sexual relations with numerous female employees inside a locked training room during working hours at the VA property, according to House VA committee documents. The male employee initiated sexual encounters on many occasions inside the training room with women on staff after offering to act as their personal trainer, according to the documents. He had sexually suggestive conversations with 30 to 40 women and then engaged in sexual acts on VA property, according to the findings. The whistleblower said he had the lock changed on the training room door and he was the only employee with the key. An internal investigation was launched after one of the women came forward with a complaint, prompting interviews and corroboration from other employees, according to the House VA committee documents. Some of the employees said the facility leaders knew about the misconduct for at least a year before taking action. The male employee no longer works at the facility, according to the House investigation. Whistleblowers provided details about three cases involving sexual misconduct, sexual harassment, and consensual sexual activities occurring during several months at the facility, according to the House investigation's findings. The dates when the incidents occurred and for how long they took place have not been disclosed. None of the male staffers who faced complaints of sexual misconduct, harassment, and inappropriate sexual behavior still work at the facility, according to Terrence Hayes, the VA press secretary. He said the VA cannot discuss the cases while it has an open investigation. We continue to fully cooperate with all proper authorities in this matter, Hayes said. But most accused the VA of delays in turning over critical documents, including performance reviews that might show when senior leaders at the hospital first learned about each case and whether they allowed the problems to persist without taking disciplinary action. Sharif El-Nahal, Undersecretary for Health at the VA, initially shared complaints from employees in July with the House VA committee, which launched its investigation and conducted an on-site visit to collect information and interview staff. In one of the cases, a female worker at the hospital filed an equal employment opportunity complaint after her supervisor promised to promote her if she would have a romantic relationship with him. The woman at first agreed to date him, but she later ended the relationship and filed a no-contact complaint against the manager, which he violated repeatedly, according to House documents. An internal review by the VA facility substantiated the woman's complaint. The manager resigned after leaders at the facility moved to terminate him, according to the findings. But the woman said facility leaders were aware of his misconduct for months and delayed taking disciplinary action against him until she filed the EEO complaint. In a similar but separate case, a facility manager promised a female employee several promotions in return for sexual favors at his office. Though the hospital's senior leadership learned of the problem, the manager was not disciplined, according to House documents. The woman later reported he threatened her job and physically assaulted her when she did not comply. Several supervisors learned about his conduct but failed to act, according to the female employee. The manager resigned 7 months later after the VA Office of Inspector General launched an investigation, according to House committee documents. Bust said he is concerned senior leaders at the VA Mountain Home facility were aware of a pervasive environment of sexual misconduct and allowed it to persist. He said there are several other employees who engaged in sexual activities at the workplace who continue in their jobs without consequences. The committee continues to wait for documents to reveal whether senior leaders in Mountain Home and those who participated in sexual activity at work will be appropriately disciplined, Bost said. That's disturbing and disgusting. House lawmakers investigate rampant sex harassment misconduct at Tennessee VA facility. Our next item is a follow-up to an article that I read last week. Judge dismisses lawsuit seeking return of Confederate Gray Ghost to Ranger Memorial at Fort Moore. It's by Corey Dickstein of Stars and Stripes from the 17th of December. Atlanta. A federal judge on Monday dismissed an Army Ranger Foundation's lawsuit seeking the reinstatement of a prominent Confederate officer's name to the Ranger Memorial at Fort Moore. U.S. District Judge Clay Land wrote he was unpersuaded by the National Ranger Memorial Foundation's arguments that the Defense Department overstepped its authority in removing the name of Confederate Colonel John S. Mosby from the Georgia Post's monument. The judge wrote, "The Pentagon acted appropriately and lawfully in removing Mosby's name under the 2020 law that established a method to remove items honoring the Confederacy and those who served it voluntarily from U.S. military installations. It is beyond reasonable dispute that the United States Congress, consisting of the duly elected representatives of the American people, has the authority to decide whether Mosby should be memorialized and honored on a United States military installation," Land wrote in the 24-page order issued just days after a December 12th hearing in his downtown Columbus, Georgia courtroom to examine the merits of the case. "Congress has determined that he should not be, and the court finds that its determination was properly implemented by the Secretary of Defense." Mosby was an antebellum lawyer who opposed slavery and secession, but ultimately volunteered for the Confederate Army out of loyalty to his family and native state of Virginia, according to his post-Civil War writings. Known as the Gray Ghost, Mosby commanded a cavalry battalion known as Mosby's Rangers, which conducted daring raids on Union forces, often behind their lines. In 1992, he was inducted into the initial class of the Ranger Hall of Fame. He remains the only Confederate ever admitted into the group. Last year, the National Ranger Memorial Fund, which oversees fundraising and upkeep of the memorial, sued the Defense Department and top officials, including Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, seeking to return Mosby's name to the monument. They argued the Naming Commission, a panel created by Congress to study and make recommendations on removing Confederate-tied items from the Defense Department, omitted Mosby's name on the Ranger Memorial and in the Ranger Hall of Fame in its massive list of items for removal in the annex of its first of three official reports. But the commission did specifically identify Mosby's name for removal from those items in the body of that report, which also recommended the changing of names for nine Army posts that previously were named for Confederate leaders, including Fort Moore, which was then known as Fort Benning for Confederate Brigadier General Henry Benning. Fort Moore is home to the Army's Ranger School, the 75th Ranger Regiment's headquarters, its 3rd Battalion, and the annual Best Ranger competition. Officials with the National Ranger Memorial Foundation did not immediately respond Tuesday to requests for comment about the lawsuit's dismissal. Foundation officials previously had vowed to continue their efforts to have Mosby's name restored to the monument and Ranger Hall of Fame, no matter the lawsuit's outcome. Jonathan Corley, a lawyer for the Ranger Foundation, told Land on December the 12th that the judge should allow the suit to move forward to the evidence-gathering stage to determine whether the Naming Commission had intentionally omitted Mosby's name from the list at the end of its report. Land posited the omission was likely a clerical error and wrote in his Monday order that the Foundation's argument drew an absurd conclusion that the Naming Commission's report meant anything other than to remove Mosby's name from the monument. The law does not specify what form that list should take and does not mandate that it must be an itemized appendix or inventory, the judge wrote. The statute's plain language does not preclude an interpretation that items could be listed for removal in the body of the report as the Mosby items were. Land also wrote that he was unpersuaded by the Foundation's other arguments, including that the Pentagon did not have standing to alter the monument because it was a gift from the Foundation, which has continued to maintain it, and the Naming Commission failed to consider Mosby's post-Civil War federal service, including decades of service as an assistant attorney general and as the U.S. consul to Hong Kong. The judge wrote Mosby's induction into the Ranger Hall of Fame and inclusion on the memorial as a prominent Ranger spanned only from his time as a Confederate officer, thus meeting the legal criteria for removal. Mosby's Ranger tactics and methods may be worthy of admiration and respect in some quarters, Land wrote, but other Americans may genuinely conclude that the development and deployment of them as an officer of the Confederate States of America in an open rebellion against the United States adds a treasonous taint that overcomes the appropriateness of any tribute to the effectiveness of some specific maneuver or survival technique. Land was nominated to the federal bench in 2001 by President George W. Bush and was a former city councilor for Columbus and a Republican state senator in Georgia. That article was Judge Dismisses Lawsuit Seeking Return of Confederate Gray Ghost to Ranger Memorial at Fort Moore. Our last item from Stripes.com, Robert Fernandez, one of our Pearl Harbor attack's last survivors, dies at 100. This is by Wyatt Olson of Stars and Stripes from the 12th of December. Robert Fernandez was a 17-year-old boy with a sense of wanderlust when he enlisted in the Navy in August 1941. 4 months later, he was working as a cook aboard the USS Curtis docked at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, the morning of the cataclysmic Japanese surprise attack on December 7th, 1941. "I just thought I was going to go dancing all the time, have a good time, see the world," Fernandez recalled in a 2016 interview. "What'd I do? I got caught in a war." Fernandez, who died Wednesday at age 100 in Lodi, California, was among the hundreds of service members who survived the attack. His death leaves barely more than a dozen Pearl Harbor veterans still living. Fernandez had planned on attending the annual commemoration of the attack held each year at the Pearl Harbor National Memorial in Hawaii, but a sudden downturn in his health forced him to cancel at the last minute. His photo and short bio had been included in the ceremony's program along with those of only two other veterans of the attack who attended. His death was announced in a post on the social platform X by Pacific Horse Historic Parks. Fernandez was busying himself in the ship's mess the morning of December 7, 1941, anticipating liberty later in the day. When the ship's alarms went off, he raced up to the deck of the Curtis, a seaplane tender. Fernandez recalled in 2016 for the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project. "A plane flew past him, so close he felt he could reach out and touch it. And the pilot didn't even look at me. He just kept on going," Fernandez said. "I just run right home to my battle station. All I could see was a red ball," he said, referring to the rising sun emblem on the plane. He was scared. "My knees were knocking," he said. "I seen a couple guys on the deck just praying and praying and praying." Fernandez's battle station was three decks below where he was sealed up like they do in a submarine, he said. His job was to pass ammunition to the gunners. The Curtis was one of few ships that managed to get underway during the attack. The ship's crew sighted the periscope of a Japanese midget submarine in the harbor and fired upon it. Shipboard gunners hit a Japanese plane, which crashed into the Curtis. Minutes later, a Japanese dive bomber struck the ship and damaged several decks. 21 crew members of the Curtis died that day, with many more than that wounded. Fernandez served aboard the ship for the rest of the war. It saw service during the battles at Midway, Guadalcanal, and the Solomon Islands. He was discharged from the Navy in 1947. And that's Robert Fernandez, one of Pearl Harbor's attack's last survivors, dies at 100. You're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org. Additionally, the Sun Sounds of Arizona stream and individual programs are available on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, which is available from the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. Let's turn now to an article from the VFW magazine by Dave Spiva. It's from the issue's upfront section, Current Veterans' Concerns, an immediate battlefield assessment. New rapid traumatic brain injury tests could be a step forward in military's efforts to provide forward-deployed troops with higher-quality health care. With this advancement, healthcare teams can diagnose a concussion in just 15 minutes with a few drops of blood. The Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, in March approved the use of a new rapid blood test that can diagnose a mild traumatic brain injury, or TBI, in a combat or training environment where advanced equipment is not available. The new test can give healthcare providers results in about 15 minutes using a small blood sample. The portable blood analysis system is a faster alternative to traditional methods such as computed tomography, or CT scans, or magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI tests. In addition, patients can be evaluated up to 24 hours after an injury with the new device. This will help provide an immediate battlefield assessment of potential trauma and facilitate the necessary high-quality care required to mitigate any long-lasting effects, said VFW National Veterans Services Director Michael Figuelli. The VFW believes this advancement also will make it easier for veterans to receive any post-service health care related to these types of injuries and substantiate any future disability claims. Developed by the Army in collaboration with Abbott Laboratories, the testing device uses a small blood sample to determine if an individual sustained a concussion. Administering the test on-site will ensure troops receive timely medical treatment that could potentially allow for a faster recovery time and reduce long-term damage. Healthcare providers use a portable cartridge-based device called an iStat for the blood analysis. The FDA approval of the device is part of the ongoing efforts to enhance military medical care. Nearly 500,000 troops were diagnosed with a TBI between 2000 and 2023, according to an Army press release. The Army also reported that concussions are the most type of TBI among soldiers. Army Lieutenant Colonel Bradley Dengler, director of the Military Traumatic Brain Injury Initiative at Maryland's Uniformed Services Academy, said the new test can help get the most severely injured service members to neurosurgeons faster, potentially saving lives. Given the large numbers of expected casualties with all severities of traumatic brain injury in future large-scale combat operations, this test can help maintain combat power far forward by helping to eliminate unnecessary evacuations, Dengler said. Dengler added that the future versions of the device could be used to evaluate more severely wounded troops on the battlefield. He said elevated biomarkers in a patient's blood correlate with the severity of the wound. And that is an immediate battlefield assessment, or new rapid traumatic brain injury test, from the VFW magazine. We'll turn to military.com again for this article from the Marietta Daily Journal, reported on military.com by Jack Lindner. Soldier reunited with dog he met while deployed overseas. Cumberland, Georgia. For 8 months, Army Specialist Landon Natty and his puppy, Leppo, called Camp Nothing Hill in northern Kosovo home. Before returning to the U.S. in November, Natty thought he would never see his pup again. But thanks to help from the nonprofit Paws of War, the two were reunited Tuesday at the Embassy Suites Atlanta Galleria Hotel. Upon seeing his former owner, Leppo's tail immediately began to wag as he made his way to Natty before lying at his feet. It was the first time the two had seen each other since the first week of October. Going forward, Leppo will now call Natty's farm in the city of Dallas home. Humble beginnings. The duo first met while Natty, 20, was stationed at the camp in his first overseas deployment. As an indirect fire infantryman, Natty served in the southeastern European country from February to early November. Dogs and cats are usually found outside the camp walls, he said, and oftentimes dropped off by locals who wish for the animals to get help. When a great Pyrenees and her litter of puppies showed up at the door, Nadi and fellow service members volunteered to take care of the group by giving them attention, feeding, and playing with them during their free time. Growing up in Paulding County, Nadi lived with his grandmother, who was nicknamed Ellie Mae after the character from the Beverly Hillbillies, due to her love of animals. Because of this, Nadi was no stranger to having pets in the house, at one point owning a pet deer after his grandmother saved it from the side of the road. In a litter of energized pups, Leppo, first named Onyx, stood out to Nadi for his calm demeanor, and the two quickly bonded. It was the right time, the right place, Nadi said, and it was like Bonnie and Clyde. Nadi eventually renamed the pup Leppo after Leposavik, a nearby town outside the camp. The name change was meant to remind him and Leppo of the beginning of their friendship, Nadi said. Their meeting could not have come at a better time. Nadi said, since moving to the other side of the world away from friends and family left him feeling isolated. Whenever military or personnel challenges come about, Nadi said it was hard to cope with since he did not have his family or friends to turn to. Although he had the company of fellow service members, everything changed when Leppo arrived. When those life challenges come and hit you like a truck and you're stuck and there's nothing you can do, it's awesome to be able to pet a dog, he said. It's also good to know that he, Leppo, almost confides in me. How it works. Nadi did not think he'd ever see Leppo again when his deployment ended, but thanks to a good word from his senior officers, he learned about the possibility of bringing his new best friend home with him. The Pause of War aims to alleviate the suffering of veterans, first responders, and their families, particularly those battling post-traumatic stress disorder, by providing them with loyal service dogs. The nonprofit rescues and trains dogs from local shelters to become not just companions, but also catalysts for healing, according to Gary Bauman, overseas rescue coordinator with Paws of War. Oftentimes, Paws of War will also rescue dogs and cats from war-torn regions and reunite military personnel with the animals they form bonds with during their service. These efforts are to take care of both the animals and the service members taking care of them. Soldiers get so attached to these animals, and there really is no process for them to bring a dog or cat back, so it's heartbreaking for them, Bauman said. Our organization's motto is helping both ends of the leash. Once Nadi heard about the program, he said he immediately jumped at the chance of bringing Leppo home. But the process of bringing a dog back to the U.S. is much easier said than done, according to Bauman, who described it as insanely hard. Due to the significant lack of veterinarians and animal hospitals in certain regions, it can take up to 2 months for Paws of War to give one animal all the required veterinary care and vaccinations necessary for migration. Finding a flight can also be a challenge, Bauman said, since some airlines don't take animals in their cargo. Sometimes a nonprofit will need to send a representative overseas to fly the animal back to the U.S. All funds are provided entirely by donations to Paws of War, Bauman said. Once in the States, dogs are then sent to the Paws of War headquarters in Neskanset, New York, where they're evaluated and given additional training before being returned to the service members. Throughout Paws of War 10 years of operation, they've successfully reunited over 600 dogs with their respective service members. In Leppo's case, once he was cleared for the move, he was transferred out of Kosovo to the U.S. during the first week of October, 1 month before Nadi's return from deployment in early November. Their reunion Tuesday was the first time they'd seen each other in over 2 months. It was almost like seeing your family again, Nadi said. I know it was only 2 months, but it felt like forever. In addition to bringing the dog to Georgia, Bauman said Paws of War will be covering all of Leppo's medical and pet insurance costs for the remainder of his life. We try and take care of the soldier and the dog for life, Bauman said. Whatever the dog needs, we're there for them. Looking ahead, the pair will move back to Nadi's home in Dallas, where he lives with his great-aunt, Brenda Feenstra. Located on a farm, Leppo will get to interact with some of Nadi and Feenstra's other pets, including horses, chickens, goats, and other dogs. He's definitely going to get to know the land, Noddy said. That is, soldier reunited with dog he met while deployed overseas. Next from military.com, we have Tom Cruise honored by U.S. Navy for his role in Top Gun. This is from the PA Media DPA, published December 17th and reported on military.com. London. The U.S. Navy has praised Hollywood star Tom Cruise for boosting the force's recruitment of pilots with his role as Lieutenant Pete Maverick Mitchell in the first Top Gun film. Cruise, 62, was presented on Tuesday with the Distinguished Public Service Award, which rewards civilians for acts of heroism or support to the Navy. It was awarded to him by U.S. Navy Secretary Carlos de Toro at the Long Cross Film Studios in Chertsey, a town southwest of London. The actor, who is known for performing his own action stunts and is a licensed aircraft pilot, reprised his role as Lieutenant Pete Mitchell in the 2022 sequel Top Gun Maverick. Del Toro said it brought nostalgia to older audiences and reinvigorated the minds of newer audience members. Del Toro said Cruise's role as Maverick in the 1986 action film about a young naval aviator who trains at the U.S. Navy's Fighter Weapons School, also known as Top Gun, significantly increased the force's recruitment numbers. The U.S. Navy Secretary, who stopped at the studios on his way to visit American forces in Bahrain, gave the award to Cruise for his exceptional and wide-ranging contributions made to the Department of the Navy from 1986 to 2023. He told the audience of Hollywood professionals and U.S. Navy staff, Tom Cruise has spent nearly four decades as an unwavering supporter of the men, women, and families of the Navy and Marine Corps. His dedicated support to our sailors, Marines, and civilians through his efforts in the film industry increased public awareness and appreciation for our highly trained personnel and the sacrifices they make while in uniform. He quipped, as a result, recruitment for Navy pilots increased significantly in the late 80s and early 90s. I wonder why. Wearing a dark suit and light blue tie, Cruise said after receiving the award, in life, something that's very true to me is to lead is to serve. I know that to my core, and I see that in the servicemen and women. I appreciate everyone's dedication, and it's a true honor to represent them. He added, I'm just very proud and overwhelmed. Cruise said he would continue serving the country to make the world a better place. Asked whether he would perform a stunt on the set, which comprised fake escarpments about 5 meters tall, Cruise joked, it's way too low for me to jump from. Other movies starring the Hollywood actor were mentioned during the event, including the 1989 biopic Born on the 4th of July, the 1992 legal drama A Few Good Men, and the two latest installments of Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, and The Final Reckoning, expected for release in May 2025. The brief ceremony was attended by a handful of film professionals and U.S. Navy staff. They included film producer and director Christopher McQuarrie, who collaborated with Cruise on the latest Top Gun movie, and four installments of the Mission Impossible franchise. Cruise's sister, Cass Caprazorio, and Chris Diaz, Chief of Staff to the Secretary of the U.S. Navy. Del Toro, the 78th U.S. Navy Secretary, was at the set with his wife, Betty. Cruise thanked the audience and staff for coming early to the set before he got on with his busy filming schedule. That's what I do. I get on the 4 a.m. train and make films all day, he said. Top Gun was a box office success and spawned famous one-liners by Cruise's character, including, I feel the need for speed. Directed by the late Tony Scott, brother of Sir Ridley Scott, the 1986 film also starred Meg Ryan, Val Kilmer, and Kelly McGillis. And that's Tom Cruise honored by U.S. Navy for his role in Top Gun. Next from military.com, we have your projected military pay raise for 2025 plus veterans pension and BAH updates. This is from Military.com by Amanda Miller, Rebecca Keel, and Tiffin Thiessen from the 18th of December. Congress appears poised to fully approve a pay raise for U.S. service members, including a massive bump for junior enlisted troops, headed into 2025 as part of the annual defense policy bill. Under the National Defense Authorization Act, which received approval in the House on December 11th and the Senate on December 18th, troops in the ranks of E1 through E4 will see a 14.5% raise next year, while all other service members will get a 4.5% pay bump. The proposed pay raise now requires President Biden's signature to become law. The across-the-board 4.5% raise for all service members will take effect at the beginning of 2025, while the extra 10% raise for junior enlisted troops will kick in at the start of April. With the 14.5% raise, junior troops will earn about $3,000 to $6,000 more per year, depending on rank. For example, E1s will make $27,828 a year, compared to $24,206 now, while E4s with at least 6 years of experience will make $44,107 compared to $38,368 now. The pending 4.5% raise doesn't quite match service members' 5.2% increase in 2024, or 4.6% in 2023, but it still tops the 2.7% and 3% raises in 2022 and 2021, respectively. While not as high as the House panel's initial 19.5% proposal for a junior enlisted raise next year, the compromise 14.5% raise marks a major win for younger troops who have struggled for years to afford basic necessities such as food. 2025 Veterans Pension Rates. Meanwhile, the Department of Veterans Affairs released its 2025 pension income limits. The new limits change veterans' individual rates. The actual amount paid depends on a veteran's income. The pension payment makes up the difference. Veterans of wartime service who are 65 or older and on a limited income may qualify for a veteran's pension without being disabled. Wartime veterans may also qualify who have a limited income and can no longer work. For example, for a veteran with no dependents, the 2025 pension income limit, effective December 1, 2024, is $16,956. With a spouse or child, it's $22,216. Basic allowance for housing. Another important update for 2025 is the Basic Allowance for Housing, or BAH, which will increase by 5.4% for the second year in a row. The Defense Department calculates BAH rates based on a uniformed service member's geographic duty location, pay grade, and dependency status, along with housing costs in each local market. Each year, the department releases new BAH tables in mid-December for rates effective January 1st. There's also a special type of basic allowance for housing known as BAH Transit, BAH Type 2, BAH Non-Locality, or BAH Reserve, depending on what branch you are in and your status. And those updates are available on www.military.com and searching for BAH rates. Another financial update for 2025. Additionally, the VA has released its new rates for the survivor's pension, also known as the death pension, a tax-free benefit for those paid to those eligible dependents of deceased wartime veterans. For those eligible, the VA pays the difference between your countable income and the yearly income limit that describes your situation. Finally, the 2025 dates have been released for retired military paydays, and those are also available on military.com by searching for military paydays. You can keep up with changes to your benefits by going to military.com to get the latest benefits news delivered straight to your inbox. And that's your projected military pay raise for 2025, plus veterans pension and BAH updates. Well, let's go to news.va.gov for this item. Registration for Summer Sports Clinic is open. Celebrate the resilience of veterans and the power of adaptive sports. This is from the 13th of December. Registration for the National Veterans Summer Sports Clinic opens on December 9th and runs through March 1st, 2025. The 2025 clinic will take place August 23 through 30 in San Diego, offering an extended opportunity for veterans to partake in adaptive sports. Eligible veterans can apply to attend the 2025 Summer Sports Clinic. All accepted veterans will be eligible to receive a free round-trip airline ticket to attend through the generous support of Fisher House Foundation Hero Miles. Entering its 18th year, VA's National Veterans Summer Sports Clinic is a rehabilitative and educational hands-on sporting event for eligible veterans from across the country who have a range of disabilities to engage in an array of activities, including kayaking, surfing, sailing, cycling, and adaptive fitness. Each sport will be tailored to meet the unique needs and abilities of the participating veterans. Sense of camaraderie can be transformative. Participation in the Summer Sports Clinic is not only a chance for veterans to engage in fun and challenging activities, it also offers a support network and sense of camaraderie that can be transformative. Veterans who have attended previous clinics rave about the positive impact it's had on their physical health and mental well-being, noting that the experience provides a renewed sense of purpose and community. This event is not only a celebration of the resilience of our veterans, but also a testament to the power of adaptive sports. Don't miss the opportunity to be a part of this life-changing experience. There's more information available on the VA website, and you can go to news.va.gov and search for health or top stories. And that's registration for Summer Sports Clinic is open. Next, from news.va.gov, we have online safety measures for the veteran community. It's from the 18th of December, the VA Office of Information and Technology. Cybersecurity is a top focus at VA and for veterans every day. Our online safety and cybersecurity habits affect everything we do, both at work and at home. Whether it's online banking, shopping, paying for utilities, managing our email, or searching for information, many of our daily activities happen online. This makes us vulnerable. New video from the VA's Office of Information and Technology explores these issues and answers questions like, how do I detect and avoid phishing and other attempts to compromise my identity and steal personal information and finances? What are top cybersecurity practices VA is following to protect my information? How can I incorporate cyber safety best practices in my daily life? How do I report cybersecurity incidents that affect me and my loved ones? How can I protect myself and family from threats when shopping online? And what cyber safety resources should I know and bookmark? And you can check out this new cybersecurity tips video to hear from the VA Deputy Chief Information Security Officers as they discuss things, all things cybersecurity, with tips to keep your family safe online. Probably the easiest way to find that video is either go to www.youtube.com and look for VA Cyber Tips, or you can go to the news.va.gov and search for technology, and you'll find the link to that Cyber Tips video. For more tips, you can bookmark and regularly visit the VA Cybersecurity Spot, which is at digital.va.gov/cyber, or report issues to your bank and financial institutions if you believe there's fraud or identity theft. Veterans who suspect they have been the victim of identity theft should call the VA at 855-578-5492, and you can file complaints with the Federal Trade Commission, with the FBI, and with the Federal Communications Commission. And again, those links are available to you on news.va.gov by searching for technology. That's online safety measures for the veteran community. Our last item from news.va.gov, VA and Veterans Yoga Project partner to enhance veteran well-being. Yoga provides veterans with tools to manage stress and improve physical health. This is from the 17th of December by Dr. Qian Chen, Chief Officer, Nurse Executive Healthcare Advancement and Partnerships. VA offers free online and in-person yoga classes and mindfulness training to veterans across the nation. VA hosts these classes through a partnership with Veterans Yoga Project, Incorporated, which is maintained by the National Center for Healthcare Advancement and Partnerships, or HAP. The classes provide a no-cost opportunity to veterans seeking to improve their mental, physical, and emotional health through yoga and mindfulness practices. VA and Veterans Yoga Project are working together to make more veterans aware of the benefits of yoga while offering more classes. This partnership also provides local VA medical centers with opportunities to connect with Veterans Yoga Project instructors to provide yoga classes and mindfulness resilience training to veterans, either in person or virtually through VA-approved telehealth platforms. Through this partnership with Veterans Yoga Project, we're addressing top VA priorities, expanding veteran access to care, and enhancing the overall health of veterans, said Kimberly Pugh, Health System Specialist within VHA, National Center for Healthcare Advancement and Partnerships. Including yoga and mindfulness into their healthcare routine provides veterans with additional tools to manage stress, improve physical health, and build resilience. And that's all the time we have for VA and Veterans Yoga Project partner to enhance veteran well-being. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Thank you for joining me for Weekly Reveille. This is our last show before Christmas. I'd like to wish you all the very best in this holiday season and remind you that you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming streaming on sunsounds.org. You can also listen to the Sun Sounds of Arizona stream on your Amazon Echo or Dot device.